Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, citrus growers plead with the president to stop U.S. tariffs. A jet fuel shortage could paralyze airports by October. A demand for renewable energy certificates is sparking greenwashing fears. And is Africa winning on the global hospitality front? It's Tuesday, the 29th of July. Now, in just a few days, the United States is set to impose a 30% tariff on local citrus exports, and that is a move that could leave hundreds of thousands of cartons of fruit unsold and thousands of rural jobs at risk. Now, the Citrus Growers Association has made a direct appeal to President Ramaphosa to step in and negotiate a lifeline, but is Pretoria able to move fast enough to avoid a crisis? And what are the deeper structural issues at play? I'm in conversation now with Dr. Boitshoko Ntshabele, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Citrus Growers Association of South Africa. Dr. Ntshabele, this is obviously a very grave situation. Firstly, have you had any formal response from the presidency to your letter?
Yes, we did receive a reply from the presidency, which acknowledged receipt of our letter to the president. They also recommended that we also speak to the line function departments, which is the DOA and the DTIC.
So what progress have you made in that respect then?
Well, look, we're in constant touch with both the DTIC and the DOA. So the fact that we had escalated to the president, I think it also heightens a little bit on their side that we move promptly to trying to find a solution before the 1st of August.
But dealing with those two entities says to me that the president isn't going to get directly involved, and that's what your organization wants, isn't it?
Not necessarily. I've always understood that the president would be leading, but he would also be delegating at certain points in terms of these discussions. That's what we are expecting. Similar to almost what we all saw in May when he went to the White House.
If no intervention comes by the 1st of August, and that is just around the corner, how much citrus is going to be lost, and what would the estimated financial hit to growers and the industry be as a whole?
So it's difficult to quantify that at this point in time. What we can acknowledge is that we typically export about 7 million cartons to the US. We've just gone through the peak or the middle of the season. So we're in the process of trying to quantify. So there's a lot of moving parts. For example, some of the fruit might be going to other markets. And so we're trying to follow up on what that number is in order to determine exactly what the scenarios might be in terms of the rest of the season.
Dr. Ntshabele, what is your constituency telling you right now? They must be increasingly worried about this.
That is precisely why we wrote the letter. We all are waiting with bated breath as to what happens this week, what would happen come 1st of August. We really hope that the government will find solution negotiating a mutually beneficial trade pact between South Africa and the US. And we would like to remind viewers that our view of the world is that we actually do not compete with US citrus producers. We are actually helping increase citrus consumption in the US in that we keep customers happy with our citrus when they are out of season. And then we return them back to them when their season come back online.
It seems as though you're very close to the finish line here, to, you know, at the 11th hour. Are you satisfied that South Africa's trade diplomacy has adequately protected your sector? Or is there a growing sense here that the government has dropped the ball?
Look, we're not sure where we are. What we're worried about is that, you know, it has come to this, you know, that it's almost over the line. We're not sure which way it will go. And what is promising is that in the last 5, 6, 7 days or so, there has been increasing number of deals, as President Trump calls them. So we hope that ours becomes one of those that finally announced.
Well, your industry has said, and you're reiterating, that you are willing to negotiate, but are you getting any direct engagement from U.S. trade representatives or officials, or do you think this is in danger of becoming a one-way appeal?
Look, we work closely with government, and we hope that they're also using every avenue possible. We are lucky that we've got our own people on the ground on that side that we also use to communicate our position, and therefore we have a sense that everything is possible at this point in time. And really, the clock is ticking, and hoping that by midnight on the 30th of this month, something is on the table.
Dr. Ncebele, you've also warned of job losses, not the first time that this warning has been sounded. Are you able to give us any kind of number, either seasonal or permanent, which are on the line, jobs on the line, if this tariff goes ahead?
The challenge, and maybe to paint it this way, is that if we lose this market, we lose half of this season that is currently underway. We don't know what will happen to the next season, Jeremy, and therein lies the risk. We provide employment, as our citrus growers too, in the Western Cape and the Northern Cape, to 35,000 people. And that's, you know, what we have to look at, and all of us, government and the president, also try and save those jobs.
There is an argument that South Africa some time back should have diversified its export markets more aggressively. And it obviously raises questions about why the industry is still so exposed to a single market like the United States. Is there some merit in that argument, do you think?
I would say no. So the one thing that people don't realize, Jeremy, is that we are the biggest citrus exporter, the second biggest citrus exporter in the world after Spain. We ship our citrus to over 100 markets. So if you think about that, we are probably one of the most diversified industries in South Africa. So we already ship to over 100 markets, and we are currently talking to a number of markets. For example, in April of this year, we were just in India, knocking at their door to find new market opportunities in that space. We are talking to markets in Southeast Asia Sea. So it's something that we do ourselves. So we're well ahead in terms of diversifying market access.
Which is good news, but how difficult or how realistic would it be at short notice to, say, reroute produce to India?
That's a tough one. And we've always said that when citrus is grown, it's grown for specific markets in terms of the palate, what people like in terms of taste. There's also issues of health and safety in terms of MRLs, and also phytosanitary requirements of the recipient country. So those are some of the things that make it very difficult to pivot and suddenly shift from one market to the other. Inherent in pivoting is also that you run the risk of oversupply in any one market. And therein lies the devil for the growers, in that you, once you oversupply a market, you get a drop in price, and therefore you reduce profitability of your own growers.
Well, there's no doubt this is a very serious situation, and one that we will all be watching with a great deal of interest. Dr. Boitshoko Ncebele, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the Citrus Growers Association of Southern Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa could be heading for another aviation fuel crisis, and this time it might hit during the peak October travel season. That warning coming from the Fuel Industry Association, which says outdated and conflicting fuel regulations are choking the supply chain and putting key airports, including OR Tambo, at risk of shortages. The industry is now calling for urgent government intervention to streamline regulation, approve critical infrastructure upgrades, and avert a looming disaster. I'm in conversation now with Abofane Chifolaro, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Fuel Industry Association of South Africa. And a very warm welcome, and let's get straight to it. How serious is this threat of the shortage, and which airports are most at risk?
It is a very serious area of concern for us. It mainly affects OR Tambo, because OR Tambo receives its product, mainly from Durban, which supplements, the bulk of jet fuel that comes from like Natref in the inland refinery. So about a year ago, so because this was recognized to be a problem, because the current legislative framework, the Customs and Excise Act, it does not allow for the movement of product from like a terminal straight into the OR Tambo like facilities, nor from from some of the terminals right into like a Natref. So the commissioner of the South African Revenue Service last year gave 12 months temporary relief with the hope of resolving all the legislative issues that will allow for seamless movement of products. Unfortunately, nothing has materialized out of that. We have not come to alignment in terms of like the provisions that are required without having a short-term relief. So unless if the commissioner decide to further extend the relief, it means it will not be possible to move jet fuel from the imported facilities into OR Tambo. But the other issue is that at the same time, the inland refinery is going into planned shutdown in the month of August and September. So generally this, as much as they plan, the shutdowns, they require product to be supplemented by what comes from Durban, because that is our major ports for the importation of products. So it is a serious situation. We are very concerned about it. And but I'm sure the South African Revenue Service Commissioner is very much aware of the interim relief that he has granted, that is coming to an end soon.
Beyond the Revenue Service, I'm assuming that you would have had engagement with the Department of Transport and or Energy. What kind of response have you had from those two entities so far?
At this point in time, it does not really require interaction with the department, those two departments, because it's really more a tax issue. And generally, the South African Revenue Service, it takes full responsibility of all the issues relating to the movement of products and the safeguarding of revenue that follows those products. It will be necessary to have a discussion if there was inability to land a product into the country with the Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources. Right now, we don't have an issue of bringing product into the country. The issues like how do you discharge and inject into the pipeline, and also how do you get that product, be cleared by the South African Revenue Service.
Let's talk timelines then. If nothing changes in the next few weeks, if you don't get the answer that you need from the commissioner, what's the worst case scenario come the spring travel season? One assumes that aeroplanes could be grounded.
Yes, definitely, because there is no way that our members could risk facing penalties for clearing or moving products without following the approved process by SARS. So the immediate response is to stop from getting involved into bringing jet fuel and injecting into the pipeline in contravention of what would have been the expectation of SARS. So sadly, yes, it might lead to that, and I hope it won't, because in the past, the commissioner, before this 12-month extension, he granted a 3-month extension. Then obviously it was very clear the issues that we're dealing with are not issues that could be resolved within such short time. And hence we were given 12 months with the hope that the revenue authority will have finalized the transition plans in terms of like moving away from dependence on the refineries to more like import mode and align, I mean, the rules, but that has not happened.
It's quite astonishing that the revenue service is not moving with alacrity as far as this is concerned, given the risk that you've outlined to us.
Yeah, they maintain that it's not a simple, straightforward. It requires some checks and balances before they can change the licenses from what they were like, when these facilities existed, to focusing more on the storage and importation of products at the terminals. So I think they might have also underestimated when they gave, a 12-month relief themselves, because the reason why they have not completed, their processes, it means it is requires more than 12 months. And I think what we'll prefer is really to continue to work on these short-term reliefs. We'd prefer a permanent solution in a form of amending the law so that, we've got, some sort of, certainty in terms of, like, how should we deal with, like, the revenue service when it comes to the handling of jet fuel in particular.
And just a final question, what have the carriers been telling you, if in fact you've spoken to them or they've reached out to you?
No. We have not spoken to them because it's really purely the issue that relates to our members who are the ones who are importing products. I'm sure the moment they know that there's this issue, like a meeting will be convened of various stakeholders, which is generally the case if we've got an issue. Because there's no point for us to only meet when we are like facing the problem. We know that if nothing happens from the South African Revenue Service, we are heading into a problem. It will probably be like a matter of time before we could meet and see like what is possible, to avert any crisis.
Well, it certainly is a worrying situation. Abafani Chufulato, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of the Fuel Industry Association of South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As South African companies rush to improve their ESG credentials and meet net zero targets, renewable energy certificates, or RECs, have become the new hot item in the corporate sustainability toolkit. But are they a strategic pathway to real decarbonization, or maybe just a slick shortcut that companies can buy to get on their way to some degree of green credibility? I want to talk now to Margot Ann Werner, who's legal director at Pinsent Masons and co-author of a report asking exactly that question. So, Margot Ann, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's start with the basics for the uninitiated as well. What exactly is a renewable energy certificate, and how does it differ from a carbon credit?
Thanks so much, Jeremy. So there is quite an important distinction to be made between an REC or a REC and a carbon credit. A REC in particular is a tradable intangible commodity, really. And what it represents is the environmental benefits of generating 1 megawatt hour of electricity from a renewable electricity source. So it stands for how much of the electricity that you consume can be attributed or can be linked to generation from renewable electricity technologies. In comparison, a carbon credit represents the actual offsetting of greenhouse gas emissions, either by reducing the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are emitted or removing those greenhouse gases. So they represent very different approaches, although they're very much aligned to decarbonization efforts.
So an REC, as I understand it then, is an important digital certificate that is tied to clean energy. But some critics, Margot Ann, might say it's just a paper transaction. How do they actually contribute to the energy transition in Africa? Are they doing the job?
I think we're on the path to establishing RECs as reputable representations of use of renewable energy. There are a lot of factors to take into consideration. One, appreciating what attribute are you actually claiming from your REC. Are you able to conclusively show that it is reducing your greenhouse gas footprint, particularly in relation to, and in South Africa especially, where our grid is so fossil fuel generation based heavy, can you demonstrate that your what we refer to as scope 2 or indirect emissions by virtue of your energy use is being reduced with this proof of your REC? The tricky part is that confusion as to how far can you reach or how far can you claim that attribute. And what's important to appreciate is that you need to be sure, and that's it's a good due diligence exercise, as we attorneys enjoy, is ensuring that your REC actually provides a level of what we refer to as additionality. Are you, by virtue of purchasing this REC, contributing to the renewable energy sector, either by ways of providing additional revenue to renewable energy developers so that they can roll out more projects of this nature? Are you able to demonstrate that you're using less water and less natural resources, again, by virtue of the fact that you're using renewable energy? But you must also be careful not to rely too heavily just on RECs, because again, they have a limitation. The main attribute of, as I've noted, is very much decreasing your indirect energy use emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, but is a much broader picture. And the risks we're seeing in the market is that you might be claiming the benefits of a REC, but actually not actively contributing to decarbonizing the grid, either by implementing other solutions for your business or operations to physically contribute to decarbonization.
So let me suggest then, and you'll correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, but it's voluntary and industry-led, and without any legal enforcement or oversight, it's going to be difficult, surely, for the public to trust these certificates and just maybe come to the conclusion that they're just greenwashing tools.
That's a really good point, Jeremy. So, yes, there needs to be reliance and trust in the system in which these RECs are traded. So there is an established international body that's sort of the central point where RECs are effectively verified. But it does come down to sort of to the developer's role at the very beginning of actually at that point of developing a renewable energy facility, whether it's solar PV or wind or hydro, that they develop a high integrity project that can actually demonstrate real environmental attributes and not just claim the attributes. And that makes that additionality point very attractive, especially, and just adds more value to that REC. But there are verification platforms, and in actual fact, RECs are already being traded on the JSE. So that just also goes to showing their integrity and the comfort that you can have in purchasing RECs from a reputable platform.
And what kind of, Margot, and what kind of take-up then has there been? Are South African corporates genuinely using RECs to reduce emissions at this point?
I've really sort of seen it more from the developing corporate and industrial private offtake space, Jeremy. So we're seeing the inclusion of RECs in our power purchase agreements. We're seeing that the off-takers who in the market are generally very high emitters themselves are recognizing the value and requiring that, you know, these RECs be incorporated into that PPA so that they can immediately benefit from, one, not obviously the fact they're directly purchasing renewable energy, but then also tagging on and claiming that attribute. So it's certainly a big focus in PPAs at the moment, but they are generally available. And what's interesting is that you can purchase RECs internationally, so from international projects that have REC attributes. And I think perhaps just to sum that point up is I'm hoping that we'll see an uptick in the REC trading space. But that it's coupled with, of course, other sustainability and decarbonization initiatives that support that transition process.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Margot Anne Werner, Legal Director at Pinsent Masons. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, from Cape Town to Kinshasa, Africa's hospitality sector is heating up, not just as a destination for tourists, but also as a proving ground for world-class hotel experiences with what's termed a uniquely local flair. As once popular European cities struggle with over-tourism and rising costs, African hotspots are increasingly standing out for their value, for their vibrancy and authenticity. All of this is very good news. But what does it really take to deliver global hospitality standards in vastly different African contexts? And is that that feel genuinely local? I want to put that to Joop Schoof, who is Director of Operations at Valor Hospitality Partners Africa. And let's talk a little bit about the promise and also the complexity, I guess, of building globally competitive hotels that still speak the local language. So Joop, a very warm welcome to you. The current hospitality landscape across South Africa, what do you think is driving that momentum?
I think overall, what you were saying about the state of affairs of the hospitality industry in Africa and South Africa is spot on. We are on an upward trajectory, very much so. And locally, we see that predominantly driven, if you look at Cape Town, Western Cape, by as well as local, as well as international tourism. Durban, predominantly local tourism, and Joburg remains, you know, still ticking over on corporate business. Specifically, you know, since, you know, we've come out of the COVID period, we've seen a lot of semigration happening and people needing to return back to Joburg. All of these elements, you know, for us, it's about, you know, we're in the hotel business. So if there's a need for people to stay over in a location, it doesn't necessarily mean or matter what purpose it is for, as long as we can provide that that service to them. So even the semigration, you know, that had us wondering what is that going to do to our markets has actually been playing out in the positive. So yes, the South African hospitality industry, as it stands right now, we regard it as being in a very positive note.
So the big picture, as you say, is positive. You also say that Africa is starting to outcompete Europe on average daily rate. Do you think this is a blip, or do you think this is a real trend that is now sustainable?
Whether we're outstripping Europe completely, not quite yet. I mean, if you look at a, you know, average room rate in London, you can easily, you know, be sitting at the 500-600 in pounds, which is not quite what we're achieving yet. But Africa in itself stands on its own. I mean, our hotel in Kinshasa, the Hilton in Kinshasa, is running at ADRs, average room rates, as we call them, of well under $200. Which, if you then compare it to Johannesburg, you know, Johannesburg will be sitting around $100. So, you know, the African performance, we often don't speak about it a lot, but it's actually doing a whole lot better than what we think it is. It's not, oh, South Africa is great, and therefore Johannesburg will be a better market. Mm. Quite frankly, we're taking earnings that are 3-4 times as much in Kinshasa than we are in Johannesburg.
How difficult then is it to strike a balance between international brand standards and, as I referenced at the start of our conversation, that authentic local experience?
Yeah. Well, look, that's exactly the niche that we find ourselves in, and that's our happy space. You know, in our portfolio globally, we have over 100 hotels, of which 99% is international branded. So we know the international brands and their standards really well. But at the same time, in the African space, you know, we really know, you know, the footprint of what works in Africa. And for us, what our job is on behalf of our owners is to actually marry up these two elements. And this is the interesting part that we find with the international brands being able to adapt more and more to it. They come in with international standards, which is great, and we like working with them, but we adopt them to the locality of a specific region or node. And in Africa, that is different from every single country to every single country. I'll give you an example. You know, if you were to build a stock standard Holiday Inn, you would have one restaurant and one bar, you know, and 150 rooms. But in a lot of these African countries where we are located, there's not a big offering of restaurants around the properties. So we then generally tweak the setup for the hotel owner to have multiple F&B outlets to create that experience so that people don't have to venture out into the city or urban node where they find themselves. And I mean, that's just one element, but that's the interesting niche that we're working in, is taking the international brand standards, not letting them go, rather adjust our timelines to make sure that we still deliver on these standards, but really understand why people travel to a certain node like Lubumbashi and what is it that they need differently from an international brand in that specific node.
What do you think the biggest difficulty then is holding the sector back right now? Is it infrastructure? Is it better training? Is it more investment, or maybe a combination of all of that and more?
A couple of things. I think the cost of capital is difficult for developers and owners to put new projects in the market. Africa always has had a very large fallout percentage between plans and actual hotels being built. So cost of capital is one. Connectivity is another big one. The connectivity, airline connectivity in Africa is challenging at times. I mean, when we visit our properties in Cameroon, it can take us up to 22 hours to get there. And we have to fly Cape Town, Joburg, Addis across. So connectivity is another big thing. And I think Africa as a whole, we're sitting on something unique that no other continent has, but somehow we're not bringing that message across well enough yet. And, Africa is one of the last places where you can still have this natural beauty around you that is never going to go away. And that's one of our strongest cards. But are we collectively really, really reinforcing that message well enough? So I think those are the three main elements for hotels: cost of capital, connectivity, and a consistent, let's call it the brand story of Africa.
And in terms of that connectivity, that's interesting because there's not enough intra-African travel to support hotel growth, surely. You're still, for the short term at least, going to be reliant on international arrivals.
Wouldn't necessarily say that we're reliant necessarily on international arrivals. I think there is a very strong case for a lot of business hotels that are reliant on intra-Africa travel. It just takes a whole lot longer to get there. Let me give you an example. We have, just under 40 properties in the UK. One director of operations there can visit, let's call it, five or six hotels in one day. Here, it might take you 4 days. And that's for us. That's for people in the industry, for our clients and our guests to be able to get to certain outlying areas. It's challenging. And not even outlying areas. I mean, if you look at the map of connectivity, there's good connectivity on the east side, Addis, Nairobi, all from Johannesburg. But if you look at the west, it's very complicated. And that's a deterrent.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Joop Skof, who is Director of Operations at Valor Hospitality Partners Africa. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy, and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.